The Lara Murphy Show, episode 59.
Welcome to The Lara Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Greetings, everyone. We have what might be termed a bonus episode here for you. This is going to be the speech that I recently gave. This is Bob Murphy speaking to you, folks, in case you couldn't tell. Speech I recently gave to the Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party. This happened on June 30th, 2018. It was in New Orleans, if you want to say it in a way that provokes anger from the residents. So this, again, was the what's called the Libertarian Party's Mises Caucus. It was a very fun event. And again, it happened on June 30th, 2018 at the Intercontinental Hotel in New Orleans. And so this was an event that the Mises Caucus formed because there were some people who thought that the National Libertarian Party lately has been putting up candidates, at least at the, you know, for the presidential slot, that were not the best representatives of libertarianism with a small L. Let's leave it at that. And so that's the context here. There were a lot of fun talks from people like Scott Horton, and Tom Woods gave the dramatic finale. So anyway, here's what I had to say to these folks. Hope you like it.
So our next awesome speaker tonight, even though I was a fan, I am currently a fan, not just was, for many years, I finally met him for the first time last fall at a little event called the Contra Cruise, which, let me tell you, that may have been, I know these guys are working me today, but that was the hardest work I've done for a week ever, but it was the best week I've ever had in my life. This was amazing, so please go if you are even thinking about it. I won't be there this year, but it'll still be awesome. So please welcome our next guest, senior fellow at the Mises Institute and co-host of the awesome podcast, Contra Krugman. A huge welcome, Bob Murphy.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you so much.
Well, I really feel bad for you guys. You came thinking you were going to get Dave Smith and you ended up with Michael Bolton. You'd be chanting refund. Fortunately, it was free. So this is not a joke here. I was walking into the hotels moving my books, which many of you bought, and I appreciate that very much. I'm all against fiat money except when you're giving it to me. And I saw a sticker, like, you know, coming into the lobby outside. I'm guessing it's from somebody in our group. It's a sticker that says, "End the Fed." Did one of you guys... So if someone wants to climb, I'm assuming it's our group. For all I know, Bill Weld at his luncheon was like, "Where's my sticker?" He's, you know, surrounded by morons. All right, so. All right, I only have a limited time with you guys here. So I was brainstorming, trying to come up with what sort of things do I want to talk about to share with you. Some of this is going to be repeats, like various chunks of this I've given at other places. And I was feeling bad about that. But you know what? I've heard all of Jordan Page's songs before. He doesn't bother repeating it. So I'm going to do the same thing with you guys here. And some of this stuff, like I say, it's, you know it, but it's also, you know, you go to church and people don't just say, "Oh, talk about that Jesus guy again." I mean, this is stuff that you need to hear. And so I'm going to go ahead and not be apologetic about it. So the first thing I want to stress is, and I think sometimes libertarians in particular fall into this trap, and you think that, oh, the reason the people running the state are in power is because they have all the guns, or they have more guns than the average person does. And that's certainly a component of it, but that's not really the essential element. It really is an ideological feature. The way Mises talked about this, he says this in several places in Human Action. He says that governments rest on the consent of the public. All governments are popular in the sense they rest on public opinion. And he wasn't just talking about what we would call Western democracies. He meant even dictatorships. Okay, Mises fled Nazi Germany. All right, so it wasn't that he was naive, and yet he still said that. And he was going back, he was quoting David Hume, who had said things like that, that in the long run, all governments rest on the consent of the governed. And what their point was is to say that ultimately, if the people, you know, don't like a government, if it loses ideological support, it's going to fall. And you might say, you know, well, okay, but what if the army, you know, can't they just subjugate the population? But Mises points out, and he says, what is it that makes the army point the guns toward the people and not turn and point towards the ruler, right? And so, and that is an ideological thing. Now, we could, you know, there, you can get nuanced with it and talk about game theory and get into what if we all hate the government, but we're all afraid that we're going to get punished and we don't want to defend. Okay, but Mises clearly, you see the big picture of what he's getting at there, that that education beliefs are important. And I can prove that to you by saying if really the power of the government or the state rested primarily on the amount of weaponry they had or their willingness to be cruel or that sort of thing, then you would expect that in dictatorships where the state was the most powerful and where they had no rule of law, where you knew if you stepped out of line and criticized the government, you were going to disappear, you would actually think in that place that schools would be wide open, that you'd have all sorts of internet access and whatever, because if it were really the guns and the threats that were keeping people in line. But of course, it's the other way around. It's precisely in places like North Korea and other places where the state is the closest to absolute domination of anywhere else on earth, where they are the most vociferous in maintaining this public aura, this public opinion, right? That they raise you to think that the government is really your best friend and looking out for you, and that it's hard to, you know, get an alternate opinion where they really regulate the internet. Also, things like if graffiti goes up in a regime like in North Korea, like somebody sneaks out and says something against the regime on an overpass, they very quickly get rid of that, right? And why do they do that? Because that is an extreme example. That's a very strong blow against the regime, because people are walking around and they see graffiti that's against the regime. It's not just that the people who see that, who might have been wondering, is it just me? Or, you know, they know some of us must really hate this person in power or this whole regime, but we don't know how many of us there are. To see something that's a public slap in the face, you know, okay, number one, at least the person who put that up there was willing to risk his life to do it. So that gives you some encouragement. But it's beyond that, is you see that and you know that everybody else is seeing it, right? That's why it's so subversive. And likewise, you know, now we have the techniques like things like YouTube videos and whatever to be able to see how many views something has, right? So remember that video that went viral with the Bernanke? Do you remember that one that was like from several years ago? And so that was, the reason that was so great was partly because you saw how many people saw it and thought it was funny. So it sort of encouraged us that, oh, it's not just me. Okay, this is great. So that's the sort of thing now that's becoming much easier, of course, to leverage and to quantify. But my point here is just the more modest one to try to make sure you realize that public opinion, even though there's a sense in which, oh yeah, the state relies on cages and guns and so on, ultimately, there's hundreds of millions of people in the United States. There's only a few thousand that are really in, you know, what you might call the power elite, sort of running things, if you will, and they are vastly outnumbered. They have to try to make it so that the public generally just doesn't really worry about this kind of stuff. And so that's why somebody comes along and brings up the Federal Reserve and they go into full panic mode and have to immediately, you know, cast this person as a crazy guy because they don't want the public looking into this stuff, right? So that's what I really want to make sure you take away from this, is that public opinion is critical, and that's how even the most tyrannical governments stay in power. So out of that insight flows the idea, and that's why I and other people, and I know Jeff was up here, Jeff Deist earlier, you know, that for me personally, that's what I'm trying to do, is just provide education to teach people how a free society works so that we know what are we moving towards. Now, lots of people up here have been talking about various strategies, and I am all for that, right? It would be silly to say, oh, the one path to liberty is going to be such and such, because that, of course, would be, you know, just putting all our eggs in one basket and saying that one of us knows how to centrally plan freedom or the path to freedom, which would be throwing out everything we know about decentralization and relying on, you know, spontaneous emergence of the wisdom of crowds and so forth. So I'm all for all those various techniques, you know, seasteading, move into particular areas to you know, free state project, all sorts of other, you know, going off the grid, agorism, all these things, national movements trying to, you know, put people in certain political positions. I'm all for that. Now, my point is, every single one of those things, the more people who think like us, then the easier that thing will be, or the more likely it is to succeed. So that's why, for me personally, you know, my comparative advantage is in teaching and trying to get people to understand these principles to make it easier for other people to go ahead and bring others into it. So with all that, then, you raise the question, okay, so from my point of view, and this is, of course, is just from one perspective, but what is it that I would hope that the LP would do? What function does it serve in that grand scheme of things? And the obvious example, or the obvious thing that pops out, is it's a great platform for getting the message out, for educating people, to show them there's an alternative, right? It's not just the way that the people on Fox talk about it or the people on MSNBC talk about it. There is a way that, you know, avoids both of those, and that, you know, there's a consistent approach that avoids these absurdities. And so, given that, you know, and just, you know, to say that it's a cliche, of course, at this point, but I have noticed, I'm old enough that I saw the transformation when I was younger, and you would go to libertarian with a small L events, you know, the conversation would naturally come around to, number one, where are all the girls? But number two, by the way, let me just say as a tangent on that, it's getting to the point where that joke doesn't work as much as it used to. So that's a good thing to see. It still does work, don't get me wrong, but... No, it really was like the Star Trek convention when we first started. It was, not that I'm knocking Star Trek, but yeah, that's I have many interests. So, but it really was the case originally, you know, years ago when I was first going to these types of meetings, and you'd say, hey, how'd you get into this stuff? And it really was, most people would say, oh, I was reading Ayn Rand, you know, particular thing. And that was largely what it was, or maybe somebody independently had found Rothbard, but it was the most popular answer by far was Ayn Rand. Obviously, the last few years when we go to these things, and I know there's a selection bias, the kind of events I go to, but still, people, especially younger people, clearly, hands down, the number one answer they say is, oh, the Ron Paul campaigns. That's what got me into this. They also once in a while will say, oh, I was listening to Tom Woods. Yeah. To which I say, Tom who? That's what I... Yes, exactly. It's funny, back several years ago, people used to get us mixed up a lot, and then one of us put on a few pounds, and no one mixes us up anymore. So in that spirit, then, from that perspective, you can see in that paradigm that clearly, for me, again, that's not the only thing, and I don't want to say, you know, if somebody just comes out and says, oh, this is purely an educational campaign, I realize how that pulls the wind out of the sails, and you got to say, no, we're really trying to win it, and I'm not disputing any of that. But my point is, among the other functions that it serves, clearly this is a great way to educate people, to get the message out, because people are naturally interested in presidential campaigns or local elections as well. They're interested in that, and people love watching debates. And so obviously, one thing you would really want to make sure is that if there's somebody representing libertarianism in a debate, that they do so coherently and that they get, you know, people really fired up about it. So that's one of the things, and I obviously this is part of what's going on here with the Mises Caucus, so I applaud the efforts in that respect. Now, what's interesting is you might think, okay, so you're saying basically whichever ideology sort of captures public opinion, that's the one that, you know, the government is going to have no choice but to do what the masses want. And so you would think, okay, Murphy, so what you're telling us is we should try to put out a message that it appeals to as wide a group as possible, and we should really try to make sure we don't offend anybody, and we should just really be, you know, just walking around on eggshells. And no, that's the exact wrong thing to do. And you know my views, you know, I'm friends with Tom and whatever, so you can probably guess where I'm going on some of these issues, but let me take it out of the political sphere first. When I was launching a website, and then also we were dabbling in different types of podcasts I might start, somebody gave me great advice. And he said, look, there's a rookie mistake that people make when they're trying to launch a website or something and they want to get a lot of traffic. They're thinking, you know, oh, gee, I want to get as much traffic as possible, so I want my website to be all things to all people. And that's the exact wrong strategy. Or I want my podcast to be all things to all people. No, you want it to be something that's extremely narrow, a very niche thing, because you need to stand out from everybody else. There has to be a reason. And the world is big enough right now that... you want to say, okay, of all the people who really are interested, you know, in cats that are orange, my website is the go-to place, right? It's not just animal lovers. You know, it's cats that are orange, and boom, I have the monopoly on that. Everybody knows I'm the go-to place for that. You see what I'm saying? That because the market is so huge, you actually have to have something pretty narrowly defined, but you have to be the best, the most consistent, the purest thing of whatever that is, and that's how you get all the traffic. So, you know, for example, who would have thought a podcast dedicated to a weekly denunciation, excuse me, teaching about Paul Krugman would have a big audience, but it does, you see? Whereas something just generically like the Tom Woods Show, who the heck wants to listen to that? All right, so you see the principle there. And so likewise, if there is going to be a reason, if people, and other speakers have talked about this, there has to be a reason for people to get off the fence, to get out of the rut. And even though it's stupid and it makes no sense when people say, well, no, I'm not going to throw away my vote on the third party candidate. I don't want to waste my vote. And it's like, because you want to waste your vote on the warmonger. Give me a high five. That's great. Because obviously you guys know the logic. Every single individual vote is meaningless, right? So if you're going to like think of it in terms of pragmatic, then everyone's wasting his vote in that strict analysis. So my point is to get someone to deviate from that, it has to be something that stands out, that's really pure, if you will, in whatever that particular category is. And yeah, I mean, if you think about it, to try to pull and tease the logic out from someone who might object to that and say, no, because if we, you know, are really hardcore or purist or something on a bunch of these issues, we're going to alienate people. They're going to walk away. And you say, right, people who aren't libertarians. Okay. And so you're not going to be all things to all people. What you need to do is figure out, you know, the sort of people who are naturally sympathetic, and to get them to come in and be energized and to show up. And so that's part of the element. And also to get people to become libertarians. Again, going back to my earlier, talking to people about it, what they weren't saying is, yeah, I came out of the womb believing in the non-aggression principle. And I have always since age 4 thought we should privatize the nuclear stockpile. And then lo and behold, I saw Ron Paul on TV one time in a debate. And then I was like, oh, I found my tribe. That's not what people say, right? It's, you know, I've always had these leanings and I always thought that, you know, taxation was kind of weird and whatever. And then, you know, I found this, I started reading this, and then over time, the consistency force, you see what I'm saying? So it was a learning process, but you're not going to catch those people and transform them through, you know, really watered down platitudes. Now, so with all of that, let me back up for a second. And so you can see this in terms of, you know, the political success. So I was sitting back and I was trying to understand. So let me just admit, I was completely blindsided by the Trump phenomenon. I kept waiting for people to get serious, right? I thought it was a joke in the beginning and I thought it was very entertaining, but I thought eventually Republican voters were eventually going to vote for, you know, a more serious candidate. And they never did. He just kept winning. And so I, you know, in retrospect, looking back, I was trying to put my finger on, okay, what was it? And I don't really think it was the particular issues. You know, people can talk about, oh, the people are disillusioned. And that's all true. But to me, I think the single biggest thing of what Trump did was that he was unapologetic and he stood up to certain people who normally always win. And they thought, you know, they had played their, no pun intended, Trump card of saying, oh, this guy's a racist, he's done. And it just bounced off him. He kept going. And so there were a lot of people who saw that. And so I think the pundits looking at that misinterpreted it as saying, wow, there were a lot more racists in America than we realized. And this was coming from NPR. They already thought there were a lot of racists, right? So it was, so I think they misinterpreted what it was. It was more of people saying, holy cow, this guy stood up. So for some of you who are younger, I don't think you realized how inconceivable it was that someone could have said the things he said and still have a viable campaign. I mean, people talk about, I think Scott and Dave Smith have been talking about this in their podcasts about, you know, Mitt Romney's thing about, oh yeah, we had binders full of women that we were trying to get qualified. And then the media took that out, you know, out of context and made it sound like he was looking over binders of women and what did he do? He didn't come out and say, what are you out of your mind? Of course, that's not what I meant, you fools. No, he apologized, bent over backward. And so that's the way that Republicans typically have been. And so for Trump to say some of the things that were prima facie completely outrageous and then just be like, yeah, what's your point? You know, or somebody, you know, saying like, oh my gosh, you were criticizing women as fags. No, I was talking about Rosie O'Donnell. What are you talking about? You know, I mean, people were like, holy cow, who is this guy, right? And so that's what I'm trying to put my finger on specifically what now we've got used to and we sort of take it for granted, but I think it was more that than the particular nature of the things that he was saying that was so shocking. It was that he was saying stuff that was completely out of the box and then wouldn't apologize for it, and he was viable. And so I think that's partly what happened. And that's also, I think, what explains the so-called Trump derangement syndrome, where the people who are normally used to this always working, that if they say to someone is a complete racist, boom, he's done. That wasn't working. It's like, well, okay, you leave us no choice. He's a white supremacist, you know, and then they just keep upping the ante. And so I think that's partly what happened there. But that's just one example. Another example would be Ron Paul. So again, why was his campaign, why did it take off? Why was it such a big deal? Again, the same basic principle. He took very out-of-the-box positions and then didn't back down. And that was the critical thing. Right? Because politicians all the time have what they call gaffes, you know, which some people say is when they accidentally tell the truth. When they have things that come out, like Obama did that. On the campaign trail, I wish I had researched just to give you the exact specifics. But at one point, when he was still, wasn't the candidate, it was still him and Hillary, in the Democratic primaries in the 08 campaign. And Obama said something like, I mean, these countries, Iran's not a threat. It's a little country. They can't threaten us. He said something like that. And then the next week, he was totally on board with, oh, this is a serious threat and we have to contain them and the sanctions. So somebody obviously got to him and said, no, you don't talk like that. We did focus groups and right? And so he quickly reversed himself. Whereas that's not something that Ron Paul does, famously with the Giuliani moment, where a lot of people would have probably backed down and he didn't. So that's what energized people who think like that. So I just want to stress, whoever the candidate is that you end up supporting or the people, the platform, that don't be afraid to state what you believe and then stick to it, because that's the sort of thing that other people are going to see and they're going to appreciate. I would also mention, just as a side on that, just to show Giuliani and how I'm not a big fan of the man. Did anyone catch the one where it was the primaries and Fred Thompson was still, you remember that guy? And there was, unfortunately, I found it on YouTube, but you can't see the camera angle's not right, at least from the YouTube clip that I saw. But at the time, so the moderator is asking all these GOP candidates, saying, by a show of hands, who of you believes in, the humans cause climate change? And so people are going, and Fred Thompson's like, I'm not raising my hand. What is this, third grade? And then all the other people, and Giuliani, I'm not kidding you, Giuliani was like this. And so... Again, just to show the contrast and the sort of person who, if they're going to be a leader of the free world, that they don't need to take their cues from some guy who's low in the polls to see, are we raising our hand or not on this? Oh, gee, because this debate moderator clearly is in charge of the situation. All right. So again, someone has to be somebody who's not going to be like that, who's going to get up there and say things and then not wait and see, wait, is the crowd with me or not? And so clearly, Ron Paul had that. Trump had that clearly. And so I'm isolating, those particular features. So notice too, though, that this is, and so this is why here I'm going to be a little bit divisive, but it's okay. This is why the whole bake the cake thing was so annoying to me, right? And I understand, I know a lot of pro Gary Johnson people, and they were like, why are you guys so, who cares about, baked goods or whatever? You're right. In a certain sense, that is just a throwaway thing. Who cares? But on the other issue, it was like, no, that's because this is critical. This is libertarianism 101, property rights 101. Even people who aren't really libertarians understand the principle of a business owner being able to choose their clientele. They get that, and they see how weird it would be to force someone to, perform services against their will. And so for the campaign to be afraid of that and to say, well, and I heard some defenders of them saying things like, well, yeah, but, if he had gone against that, or if, he had gone against that sort of anti-discrimination law, that would have been a non-starter and the campaign would have been finished. So one could argue, well, he didn't win anyway, right? So there's that element as well. But you see how that, violates exactly what I'm talking about. Now, having said all that, by the way, let me say one good thing about him. I never participated in the, mocking him for the Aleppo thing. All right. Number one, I'm not sure I knew where Aleppo was earlier that week. All right. So I will admit that. But also, because he kind of did what I'm talking about here. If you go watch that clip again, he's sitting on the set, and the guy's like, what's your opinion of Aleppo? And he's like, what is Aleppo? And then it's clear he made a mistake. Like, they're all just glaring at him. He's like, why? He goes, are you serious? And he's like, yeah. And he was looking around. So I actually had respect for him there, that he wasn't backing down, whereas a lot of people, I think, would have, tried to grimace and hide under the chair. So I will say I did appreciate him for that. It's just on these issues, I think a lot of it is that he just wasn't that well-versed. Like, he wasn't knowingly deviating from the orthodox position. I think he didn't know what the orthodox position was. So, you know, that's a good or a bad thing, depending on your perspective. So I got just a few minutes left here. Let me end on this note. Let me say, there's a way to do all these things I'm talking about so far, so don't misunderstand me. You don't have to come off like a jerk, okay? So clearly, don't misunderstand. I am not saying, I really hope the Libertarian Party candidate is just like Donald Trump. That's not what I'm saying, and that's why I held up Ron Paul. You know, think about it. Ron Paul was not insulting people. He was very inspirational. Also notice that what Ron Paul was doing was not spending a lot of time criticizing, you know, previous candidates. And so I think, so even though, you know, we have our fun and we make jokes and something in these quarters, in this context, I don't, when it comes around to supporting whoever the LP candidate is, if it is someone that the Mises Caucus, you know, supports and so on, at that point, when you're trying to get the public to get behind something, you don't want to be, you know, having internal squabbles, all right? Because people don't want to join a group of people that are just fighting with each other, right? That we end up looking like Marxists or something. So I will say that. And beyond that, though, there's a way of unifying people, showing them, I think, to try to go out of your way to say, yes, I have these principles, but to try to show them that you don't just coincidentally always line up with the standard way that groups are divided in U.S. politics. So, for example, when the recent ruling comes out about the labor unions and public sector employees don't have to contribute to labor unions if they haven't joined, okay, yeah, we can clap for that. But so obviously, you know, you can go ahead and you know, the candidate could give talking points on that, or if you're talking with your friends or whatever, or people on social media, you can give examples of that and sort of back up. So for Republicans with a capital R who would have supported that decision, you can make those sorts of points. But then you can also say something like, you know, in a libertarian free society, if a business owner wanted to have a closed shop, he could. That would be, whereas right now, that's illegal. Did you know that? Right. And so that might, you know, get your Democratic friend with a capital D who's concerned about, you know, geez, this is hurting the working man. You could perhaps point out that, do you know right now that it's illegal? Like, you know, the employer doesn't have the right to insist on an all-union shop. That I think it was like a 1947 labor law that was ruled legal. And so you can, you know, just show that the consistency of the libertarian message. Likewise, with all these freedom of association things, you can say, yep, NBC or it was ABC with Roseanne, you know, they have the right to get rid of that. Now, we might disagree and think it was silly, but it's their property. This is not a free speech issue per se. They can do that. The owner of the Red Hen, likewise, can so and do that. But you know what? If you own a bakery shop and you don't believe in same-sex marriage, then you should also have the right. And you can just show that you're consistent, because what I found is that a lot of the people on the left who don't like, who hate the guts of Republicans when they talk about, you know, cutting welfare, it's not because they're that much against, or it's not because they hate someone's guts who's against government handouts. It's because they sense hypocrisy. They say, you guys are against handouts when it comes to food stamps, but not when it comes to, you know, Lockheed Martin. And so they sense hypocrisy. So that's why the Libertarian candidate can be consistent, anti-war, anti-state, and just unify people who think like that. Thank you very much.
And there you have it, my stirring remarks, my call to action. This is what I do when I like to be inspirational. So hope you guys liked that. And also in the show notes page, again, this is the Lara Murphy Show, episode 59. If you want to look this up in the archives at laramurphy.com. I will put a link also. Tom Woods, I know, captured his speech, and so I'll link to that at least. Perhaps Scott Horton did also. If I can find that, I'll link to it as well. So hope you guys liked it, and we'll see you next time for a more conventional Lara Murphy Show episode. Thanks.
You've just finished another episode of the Lara Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Lara Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LaraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.